This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Keith Knight creates comic strips with a message. Perhaps his best-known cartoon is a weekly syndicated comic called The K Chronicles. It's loosely based on his own life as a black man in America. And while Keith's comics often document his obsessions with nerd culture and his love of hip-hop, some of his best-known pieces offer straightforward and sometimes difficult commentary on police brutality, racial profiling, and other forms of systemic racism. Today, Keith lives in North Carolina and has found plenty of material here to revive his love of political cartoons as well. Keith Knight will be featured artist at Comic-Con later this week in San Diego, but first he joins me on The State of Things. Welcome back, Keith.
Oh, it's been a long time, Frank.
It's been a very short time, but it's so good to catch you on your way to San Diego, because I know that's getting ready for that. It's a big deal.
That's right. I have my two sons, hi, Julian and Jasper, working hard, getting all the books and artwork together, because they do all the drawing now. That's the reason why I had them.
I
could just go on
so
radio
So you're going
shows.
To get those cheap Father's Day cartoons where Billy does the cartoon today?
Is that, yeah. I'm taking that to the next level. It's like every day now.
Tell us about growing up. You grew up in a Boston suburb of Boston called Malden.
Malden, Massachusetts. It's home to Converse All-Stars. That's where Converse All-Stars were invented. And also Killer Kowalski's wrestling school. Oh. And also Jack Albertson, the uncle from Willy Wonka's in the Chocolate Factory. Was the uncle or grandfather?
Oh,
he was also the man from Chico and the Man. So that's our
wow, that is it. Now you.
And now me.
Okay.
And now me.
So what was it like growing up?
We were...
By the way, it was the grandfather.
Just so it was the grandfather. Yeah. Okay. Just working class. And it was diverse in the sense that diverse in Boston meant Italians and Irish and black people mixed together.
Getting along together.
Yeah, that was it. But, we were in the sort of even... I grew up in the apartments, which was one step up from the projects. And... but it was a great time, like just a great fun time. And it's so funny, because now when I meet people from Boston, especially in California, when I was living in California, I'd say, "Oh, where are you from?" They'd say, "Whatever." And they say, "Where are you from?" I'd say, "I'm from Malden." And they go, "Oh, I used to get beat up in Malden." So I suddenly have street credibility that I never had before growing
up. You're not a tough guy. I mean, a lot of the K Chronicles is about a nerdy kind of...
Yeah, yeah. But
Now, who knows?
You're
from Malden.
Now, like, my reputation is like I'm a hardcore Malden guy.
Were you really kind of doodling? Because this is the story, that you were kind of doodling on the walls as a toddler.
Yeah, I think we all do that. Like, we just draw all the time. And yeah, I doodled on the walls of my apartment when I was younger, but then finally started doing it on paper. But I think, like everybody draws. But what happens is teachers and parents and people encourage the ones that sort of stand out. And it sort of discourages the rest of the children, which is a shame, because I think drawing is very therapeutic, and it's a great way to take notes and remember things. So I was just lucky enough to have people encourage me. And then in third grade, my twin sister and I were invited to go to a special program in the school system called Major Works. So from fourth to sixth grade, we were in the special school where we did plays, we did puppet shows, we did a lot of creative stuff. And when we were tested, we weren't all tested together. You would approach the teacher and say, "I'm ready to be tested now." You'd get some headphones and a tape recorder, and then you'd be tested that way. So it was very independent study, very creative, and I think the best education that I ever had. But we were also the only black kids in the whole school, so that was its own education.
Did you feel that?
Oh, totally, totally.
How?
I remember that there was like this sort of one of those, you know, we were getting older, so we were having these parties, sort of, I don't know if they were makeout parties, but there was like some debate on whether my sister and I would be invited, even though we were popular kids, but we were black kids. So I remember that. That was really interesting. Mm-hmm. And just sort of, you know, even back then, sort of an absence of, you know, well, of any black contributions in any historical sense whatsoever. And so, you know, even just the awkward description of slavery was just like, oh, and the slave owners treated their slaves like family and like really nice. And you always had those happy slave films where, you know, they show the white slave owner who's really nice to his slaves and is the hero of the picture. Just even then it was disingenuous. You know, it's you don't know what the deal is because you haven't figured it out, but you like you grow up and then it did. Believe me, I'm learning more now. Yeah. I said this in the last interview. More now in my year here in North Carolina, more about the black experience in America, I've learned than any schooling I ever had in Boston and in San Francisco, where I didn't go to school, but, you know, I lived.
Is that because you find it more open? You can actually have the discussion here, or why is that?
No, I just think that once you see when you go and visit a plantation like Stagville and you see where they lived and you see how hard it was to you start to dig deeper. You start to do your research and you find that, you know, education was against you. You couldn't learn to read. You couldn't learn to write. You'd be punished by having limbs or fingers and toes chopped off. So for people to become skilled and to build that barn at Stagville that they did there, the architecture, I guess it was the largest agricultural building in North Carolina for a long time. You know, with supposedly just like no education and everything, it gives you a sense of pride that I didn't have. But you see how hardcore the experience is.
But again, think about going back to third, fourth, fifth grade where you're getting an education that's inaccurate. A sense, at least you had a sense that this isn't quite right. You've got a lot of options from that time forward. One is to just bury that thought, that discomfort, move on and never explore it. And then so rare is the individual black or white who would actually explore that discomfort years later and say, huh, you know what? That wasn't right. I mean, it's hard to imagine people actually pushing through that and coming to the next level.
Well, I think more and more people are starting to do that. And I think a lot of that has to do with hip hop. And a lot of that has to do with like late 80s, golden age hip hop, when you had people like KRS-One, you had people like Public Enemy, X-Clan, people who were saying like, look and learn about your past because you're not learning about it in school. They don't want you to know about it in school. And once you start to learn that stuff, once you start to unearth that stuff, if you look at late 80s, early 90s hip hop, you will have it will explain to you what's going on today.
Right. Not only the content, but the ingenuity in the form itself, how hip-hop is a kind of expression of creativity over and against a culture that's not allowing you the full benefit of education, musical instruments to name one, but beyond that.
Yeah, I mean, it's really such a great example of what happens. You know, American culture is essentially black culture that just permeates everything. And to see a music come up in my lifetime and watch that just sort of grow and become this worldwide, it's amazing. It's inspirational. I was in a breakdancing group. I was in a couple of bands that, you know, rap bands that mixed live music with samples and rapping. But also just sort of I really follow the way that rappers would like sell CDs out of the back of their trunks and stuff. I mean, that's how I first sold my comics. Was I would take my zines and put them and show up someplace with like a sandwich board and like sell zines at the local street fair or if there was a concert going on in Golden Gate Park and stuff. So it was very. I love the idea of sort of following that sort of example that hip hop artists.
Do you think the K Chronicles in its form and content in any way draws from hip hop culture?
Oh, totally, totally. It's I always talk about when I teach cartooning classes that it really is sort of you use the tools that are in front of you to create this tableau. And kids in the Bronx and Brooklyn created this tableau by their parents' records, taking their parents' records and creating these beats from the breaks and these songs. The walls and subways were their canvas. and sort of the cardboard box and breakdancing on the street. That was their dance floor. And to me, a pen and a pencil and a piece of paper, it costs $1.50, and you can create anything you want with it. And it took me a while, but I came to this sort of idea of pushing this perspective of a young black male, not so young anymore, but a young black male and my perspective. You're hearing my unfiltered voice, my perspective. When you see a big mainstream news channel, you know, they make the decision to either have someone of intelligence speak or pick the craziest person on the street to comment on something. And that crazy person goes out to millions of homes, and then people think, oh, well, you know, everyone's crazy like
right.
that.
Right. And that's what they think. Yeah. Well, I want to talk more about your influences, inspirations, and other aspects of the life of Keith Knight, who is an award-winning cartoonist, creators of comics, The K Chronicles, and Think. We will hear more about your development as a cartoonist and where you're headed on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio, talking this hour with Keith Knight, award-winning creator of the K Chronicles and other syndicated strips, including Think. He's going to be the featured artist at this year's Comic-Con in San Diego, which starts later this week. So let's talk a little bit about some of the formative moments in your career. One of them in high school, a moment that really encouraged you to keep drawing. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I had a really great English teacher that assigned us George Orwell's Animal Farm for a reading assignment. And it truly was the first book where I identified with the character. You know, people always say, oh, that guy in Catcher in the Rye, oh, you totally identify with that. Like, give me a break.
Yeah.
But I was so excited about Animal Farm doing this project that I said to my English teacher, I said, instead of a book report, can I do a comic book report? And Mr. Hines, he was such a great guy. He said, yeah, sure. And so I did a parody of Animal Farm. And so the story of Animal Farm is about these farm animals taking over the farm and kicking out the humans and making rules to sort of benefit the animals. So, you know, two legs bad, four legs good, all that type of stuff. So in my version, it was high school students in my high school taking over the high school, kicking out the teachers and making rules like under 18 good, over 18 bad, stuff like that. And so I did caricatures of tons of students, of teachers making, ripping everybody, really. And it was, and my teacher loved it. He went nuts. He gave me an A++ and said, like, you captured the essence of Animal Farm perfectly, but more importantly, you should be a syndicated cartoonist. And that was the first time I ever heard syndicated. Mm-hmm. And so I started to look into that and saw that, oh, okay, these are syndicates that send out all these comics to all these different papers and all this stuff. So that was when I really started to pursue the idea of being a syndicated cartoonist.
Had you thought about being a professional making art or drawing your profession before this?
Yes and no. Like, I knew it was something I liked, and I knew I was drawing, I was making fun of people and not getting my butt kicked. And so I was like, ooh, if I could get away with this in life,
yeah,
then this would be a great job. But I just never, yeah, I never knew anything about the syndicate thing. So I started doing it for my high school newspaper, my college newspaper. And in college is the second teacher I had. That was a huge change. I'm getting all froggy. I apologize. But I had an American literature teacher. Again, this is American literature teacher, just like Mr. Hines, who was an English teacher. He assigned us Jane Baldwin to read, Maya Angelou, who else? Richard Wright, all these different people. And when people brought up the idea, like, why are you giving us all black writers? He said, I'm giving you all American writers. And that exploded my head. And I was like, wow, like, this guy is, you know, being an activist without being, he's doing it within the system. So I thought that was like just a great idea. And my work, went from being about keg parties to actually taking on different issues and stuff like that.
And it's, you know, and we can watch this career path in art and in cartooning, but you could have been a musician, right? I mean, you had a band, kind of.
Yes.
Which began, I want you to tell the Michael Jackson story, because that's, I think, that kind of the beginning of this.
It was sort of the beginning. We, in my high school, they have this variety show every year, and generally, the variety show, there's a star of the show, and it's always the dance group, the four black dudes doing the dancing. And so we had our dance group, and there were a couple of other dance groups vying for it. But it was 1984 at the time where Michael Jackson ruled. Thriller was huge, and the finale of the show was recreating Thriller. And so they were looking for a Michael Jackson, and I didn't think anything of it. It was not in my head. And someone at lunch, a student, she said, Keith, you'd make a really good Michael Jackson. And a guy in my group said, nah, he's too skinny to play Michael Jackson, which is like a totally bizarre thing to
what
say.
What would that mean?
Yeah. So I was like, oh, I get it now. Like, this guy wants to be the Michael Jackson. So I was like, all right. So I go home and I learn all the moves. I watched the VHS millions of times. I learned it. And I go to try out, and it turns out he's in at the tryout with the teacher, and the teacher just said, you're not going to try out. He's going to be the Michael Jackson. So I was like, oh. And me being the very passive-aggressive person I am, I'm like, okay. And so what I did when we were practicing all our dance moves for the breakdance routine, I practiced them, but at home, I was just continuing practicing my Michael Jackson stuff. And so when I showed up to the show, I didn't wear my breakdancing stuff. I dressed up as Michael Jackson in the Billie Jean video and just did all my best moves during my breakdancing thing. And people went nuts. People went completely insane. And when it ended, we won star of the show.
Yeah.
And but more importantly, all the parents were coming up to me going, can you perform at my kid's party? Can you perform at this fair? Can you, so like, so suddenly, like, I was making $75 an hour, you know, at age 17, dressed as a Michael Jackson impersonator. So it's a graphic novel I'm working on. And it's an homage to the 80s. It's sort of a frightening sort of coming of age thing. And I call it, about a person who found himself by impersonating somebody else.
Yeah. But this leads us to the fact that you had a band. I mean, the fact that you were entered in this contest anyway with a band, were you seriously considering music at the time?
Oh, no. This is 4 years later.
All right.
What happened is in college, we became DJs. And this is the great thing. I was always hanging out with my buddies, and he had turntables, and he would just spin records, and you know, we'd listen to the latest hip hop records. And when we got to college, my cousin and I, we wanted to have one of the first hip hop radio shows on the college radio station there. And so the guy was like, "Can you guys DJ?" We're like, "Yeah," and we never really touched the guy's turntables, but just because we were in there every day just hanging out, we sort of knew. So we ended up with a radio show on there. And the guys after us were these jazz guys. They were older. They were upperclassmen, jazz guys. And one of them was a filmmaker. And he just thought we were great characters. So he's like, I want to put you in a short film I'm doing. And you guys will play rappers. And we have to come up with a song. So we came up with a song for that video. 2 or 3 years later, someone just quietly entered that song into a Battle of the Bands. And so we found ourselves in a Battle of the Bands, the finals, with no band. Like, we were just like, how did we just get in here? And no one to this day claims that they entered that song. So we put together a band in 3 weeks and wrote 5 more songs, and we won the show.
You won.
We won the show. And what was great about it was like 89. Like 88, 89, we were 2 rappers, 2 guitarists, bass, drums, and a guy on turntables. Nobody was doing that at that time. And I had a DJ who worked at FNX, which was a big Boston alternative music station. And he said, He goes, I think you guys could be really big, like, if you just continue to do this. I had already planned to move to San Francisco at the time. So what I decided to do is I got the band together. I said, listen, this guy keeps on saying that we could be really huge. I will stay a year longer if we're going to pursue this 110%. And everybody was like, yeah. Except the two guys I grew up with, my cousin and my friend Craig, they're like, nah, like, you know, we're not really into it. And now to this day, they even say, oh, wow, yeah, we could have been really big. We could have been. It's like, shut up, you guys.
Too late. So where's your cartooning career at this moment?
At that point, I was drawing caricatures. I sort of supplemented my income by drawing caricatures in Faneuil Hall in Boston for years. And I was a terrible caricaturist. Terrible. But I wrote good jokes, and I had a good banter with the crowd. So, you know, that goes a long way. And but this one guy who was the best, he's great. His name is Dale Stefanos, and he's a great illustrator. He does stuff for the NBA now, like all these great illustrations. He always got the good jobs, and he got a job in San Francisco. He came back from San Francisco. He's like, Keith, you gotta go to San Francisco. It's like a huge Harvard Square. And I used to love hanging out in Harvard Square. So I was like, okay, that's it. I'm gonna graduate school. I'm gonna work for the summer. I'm gonna drive out to San Francisco. And that's exactly what I did. And that's where I saw underground cartooning. I saw that you didn't have to be in the syndicated daily strip format. You could talk about politics. You could talk about drugs. You could talk about sex. You could do anything you wanted. And you ran in all these different independent underground magazines there. That's where the K Chronicles, as I know it is today, like, that's where it started. And it just went from there.
And where did it start in San Francisco? In other words, who picked it up first and how did
the SF Weekly was the first one to regularly run it. And I knew I had – it was only running every other week. And I knew I had made it – you know, I knew that it was going to stick when the week that it wasn't in the paper, I was listening to one of the big radio stations and the DJ said, I'm reading the SF Weekly and my only question is, where is the K Chronicles? And I was like, oh.
Boom.
Yeah. Boom.
You've arrived. When did it first make it into the mainstream papers, and did that matter to you?
It did and it didn't. I mean, I just, like, the only mainstream paper that picked it up were the SF Chronicle and the SF Examiner. They were two competing papers, and then they bought each other, and it just became this incestuous, weird thing. But it ran in there a couple of years later. And I thought I could get it in. Since I got into those papers, I could put it in any paper. So I started sending out to all these daily papers all over the place. And I started getting rejection letters from all over the place. And the best rejection letter was from the Oregonian in Portland that said, like, the editor put in, like, 60 size font letters in a family newspaper. Are you nuts? And it was just hilarious because I point that out in my slideshow. Like, here is an editor of a major metropolitan newspaper who takes the time out of his day to type this up and says, that font's not big enough. Let me make this font much bigger. And just, it was hilarious. Funny.
So, but you also talked about the experience. You talked about this last time on the show, but it's worth repeating the story about kind of how not only family newspapers, but apparently white liberals took offense, according to one editor in San Francisco.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, I had my experiences with my editor in San Francisco, but it was actually Mill Valley. My strip, again, runs in Salt Lake City, Utah. It ran in Charleston, South Carolina. It ran all these different places, all over the place. The two places I got censored the most were San Francisco and across the bridge in Mill Valley, California. And in Mill Valley, when my second strip started up, I did a strip boasting about how I was making a little bit more money now and I could flaunt my newfound wealth in an attempt to woo the ladies. So it has me drawing me and I'm going, oh, is this a cough? I think I'll go get checked out with my new medical insurance. And I'm flashing my medical card at the ladies. And it basically devolves into me standing in an alley with a big thing of crack. And I'm going, ooh, look at all this crack and nobody to smoke it with. So I get this call from the editor and she's like, we're not going to run your strip this week. And I said, what do you mean you're not going to run my strip this week? Why? And she says, well, we don't want our readers to think that all black people smoke crack. And I said, did you put that in your editorial? Like, did you say that? And she says, no, but your cartoon says that. And I said, no, it doesn't. It says, I smoke crack. There are other people, black people drawn in that comic strip, and they're not smoking crack. It just says, I'm smoking crack. Mm. And she said, but why did you do that? And I said, because it's funny. It's like anybody who's read this strip knows I don't smoke crack. And so she gets all quiet, and then she says, Keith, we have a large white liberal readership, and we do not want to offend them. So they didn't run it because I was offending white people. So,
but this gets to something. We're going to talk more about this, but we're here now, so let me ask you something you've talked about, which is how difficult it is to really have a serious conversation about race in this country. Because, again, if white liberals think they control the narrative about what is and is not offensive to black people, then it's going to be pretty hard to have a conversation that includes everybody.
It really is like for years, white people have controlled the conversation about race in this country. So the conversation about race goes for about 6.5 seconds. And then you see sort of this blank look and like it's like, oh, you're pulling the race card. That's one that they say. Or just like, get over it. It happened a long time ago. Or this or that. You know, just all this. There's a black president. So suddenly there's no more racism and stuff like that. The control has to stop, and we have to have this conversation because racism in this country is a festering wound that is a boil that is continuing to grow on, and it's not even on the butt of America, but it's on the face, and everybody sees it. Everybody sees it, but a lot of people are in denial about it. And generally, those are white people who are in denial about it. And I think it's because we do not learn about how this country truly was founded. We just hear about freedom and we hear about equality and we don't understand that it was built on the blacks, built on the blacks. Mm-hmm. I was going to say backs, but backs of blacks. Imagine having a company where for literally centuries, you didn't have to pay your workers. Literally centuries. How well would your company be doing? And that's America put itself on the map by exploiting for centuries generations of black people. And so when people sit there, and go, oh, you know, my ancestors had it tough when they came here. And this is like, your ancestors didn't come in the bottom of a boat, chained, naked, you know, being raped and being beaten. If a baby's born and they chuck it over the side to the sharks, if someone gets sick, they get chucked over the side. They weren't brought here and then just basically their whole culture, their whole families are broken up. You know, just basically people were broken. People regarded as three-fifths of a human being. The people that wrote about equality and freedom had people that they didn't even consider human beings. So when people say, oh, this something recently broke in this country. No, this country was built broken, okay? And once we understand that, and it's not going to be easy.
Let me stop you right there, though.
Okay.
The once we understand that, do you think that's true? Do you really think, like imagine that we get the room full of Americans and who have never really thought about this. And we say, you have to build capital. And once that capital is built, especially if you have a lot of free labor, et cetera, and if you keep certain people from ever even borrowing money to build wealth, et cetera, you do all that. Do you really think we'd actually get past, like, could you get past the barriers that they have and the fact that if I accept your argument and I accept your history, there's something about my privilege that might have to go away? Because imagine that, because the white person who has been born into this and has said, wow, they have their equal opportunity now. We have the Civil Rights Bill and we've got a black president, so it's all over, right? You say, well, there's a little something about your privilege. It just might have to go away. And in the back of my mind, I'm worried about that. Do you really think we'd have that conversation? Is just coming to that understanding going to be the thing that opens the doors to a conversation?
It's not. Certainly so. It's not just coming to that understanding. I mean, there's a million different things that need to happen, but it is a step in the right direction. Like when people just sit there and go, oh, if we just ban assault weapons, blah, blah, blah. Of course, if you just ban assault weapons, then that's not going to just fix everything. But there are a lot of – there is evidence that says if you ban assault weapons, there is a tiny change, you know. And when people sit there and point to Australia, there is literally – there was someone on your radio station that talked about it. It happened in Connecticut and Missouri where they went two different ways. Connecticut had put in a little bit more gun control and gun violence went down. Missouri opened it up so people could get more guns. It went up. Like, the evidence is there, but we have to do it on so many different levels. As far as like addressing police brutality and all this different stuff, it isn't simply about having a more diverse police force. That's just one step. It isn't just about learning about the history of this country and how this has gone on forever. This is not a recent thing. When people sit there and go, oh, I never heard this before Obama was president, it was nearly twice as much. Cops were getting killed twice as much in the Reagan era than in Obama's era. It's just it's not all over the media because we didn't have the internet. Like, once people saw the history now, there's a lot of people here who don't want to look back, and they don't want it because it's in their best interest to not look back.
Keith Knight is my guest today. We're going to continue our conversation in one moment. He's the creator of the K Chronicles, Nightlife, and Think, and other comics. He's on his way to Comic-Con in San Diego, and our conversation will continue in a moment. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. My guest is Keith Knight, cartoonist and creator of several comics, including the K Chronicles and the political cartoon Think. Living in North Carolina now after traveling around the United States a fair amount. You still travel around. Not only do you do your strips, but you also now do a slideshow presentation on police brutality. Tell us about that.
Yeah, about 2 years ago, I think it's now, I was doing another cartoon about police brutality, something about Ferguson, I think. And I was just doing research and for some pictures, and I saw this woman holding this sign up that, and it just says, I can't believe I still have to protest this, SH. And she just, the look on her face just encapsulated everything that I was feeling at the time. And I was like, I still can't believe I'm drawing comics about this stuff. And I just started to say, okay, how can I address this in a way that starts a conversation? So I decided to put all my comics together and on police brutality and formulated the slideshow that sort of tracks the modern era of police brutality, starting with Rodney King in 1992. And I just want to make the point that, you know, this is not new. You know, this has gone on for years and years. And that, you know, when those people were caught hitting King in 92, I use the example of my 3 year old. One time my wife and I were sitting in the kitchen, our three year old, who was probably like one and a half at the time, walked over to where we keep our keys, took out something important, walked over to the trash bin, opened it up and dropped it in there, and then just walked back. And I looked at my wife and I said, "Did you ever see him do that before?" And she said, "No." But he did it with so much confidence that this is not the first time he's done it, you know? Yeah. It's like we are just catching him. So who knows how many times that's happened? It's the same thing with Rodney King. How many times has that happened before some guy just happened to have a camcorder who looks out the window and sees that? So I'm trying to put it in the context of like this has gone on forever. And just because it was on videotape, like, I don't want people to think that it has to be on videotape to prove it. That's the danger of what's going on here. Because if we have to have video to prove it, then all the stuff, for everyone we see on video, it's happening hundreds of times and we're not seeing it. And if we have to always believe the police, like, because they're just police and that there can't be any bad police, then we're going to continue to go down the tubes as far as relations go. And when you have someone like McCrory signing this bill that, like, they can just hide, you know, the police just keep the footage, like, you can't see the footage, he is damaging the relationship between the community and police. Like, I used to look at North Carolina as, like, you know, they're in the South, but they're pretty progressive. Like, I'm not seeing that now, and it drives me crazy because I live here now.
Well, what about the argument that, you know, the police are public servants, and so much of what they do should be on the public record, but a lot of what they do ends up in private homes, and we have to protect the rights of people who they come in contact with?
Well, at this point, we're in sort of it's important to be as transparent as possible. It's important to show the public that police can be trusted and they're doing their best to weed out anybody who screws up. And for me, that's what I want to see a cop come out and say, you know what? There are some of us within the ranks that shouldn't be cops. I've seen video of behavior that is not right, and that's what I want to see.
That's part of the narrative of the good cop, the fact that maybe only a small percentage of cops are doing the really bad stuff, but nobody is outing them, that there's this wall of silence around them, and that you know, if you're going to really be a good cop, then you got to say, hey, this does not represent my values.
Listen, when I see a bad cartoon or a bad cartoonist, I call them out. I don't want them cartooning anymore because they do more harm than good. Like a bad cop literally does more harm than good.
Right. What about now? But given now what's happened in Dallas and now Baton Rouge, does that change the way we have this conversation?
Well, unfortunately, it does. Unfortunately, let me preface this by saying that shooting cops is horrible and is completely terrible. What's interesting with the two shooters was that they were military. And it sort of reminds me of the military in World War II, the black military that went overseas to liberate and free people. And then they came back to the South and they were not free themselves. And I think that these guys snapped. They went I don't know. I don't know all the details.
We can't know, right? None of us can know.
Yeah, we don't know the details and anything, but if you're going overseas and fighting and you're told, like, you know, you're free, you're going to give these people the freedom that we have back home and blah, 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 and then you come home and you watch, like, people getting slaughtered, and at this point, the feeling that there's any justice, like, that there'll be a trial and that people will be convicted for their actions, like, that's gone out the window now. Like, for me, when I can't even watch the videos anymore, but I listened to the audio of the police who shot Philandro. First of all, he shot him in front of his kid, which we had this conversation. When there's a kid around, you're on your best behavior. Like, when I don't jaywalk if there's a family there and there's kids. I want the kids to learn to be good. So here's a cop that clearly there's a child in the car. Clearly, just like, everyone's going to be on their best behavior. When you listen to that cop, I've never heard somebody so scared in my life of a family sitting in a car. Like, that guy sounds like one of those home videos, America's Funniest Home Videos, where they're coming off a roller coaster and they're freaked out. Like, that person should not be a police officer.
Oh. But let me ask you this, because there is this other question. You as a cartoonist and me as a radio host, when we see people with kids, maybe they're on their best behavior. I'm thinking police officers have been in situations where kids have been around, and that's not been true, that they have seen children in places where there's terrible mayhem and violence. And for them, the mere presence of a child doesn't mean I'm in a safe place.
Well, according to what it sounded like, he was being open and truthful, and like that he even took classes on how to deal with police officers. It sounds to me, and we have video of people who have completely followed the rules. You know, that one at the gas station where the guy is reaching for the ID and the cop shoots him anyway. And thankfully the guy lived, and he's like, why did you shoot me? Like, it's, we know that there are people who make a living going around to police departments and promoting this shoot first, ask questions later edict, which is extremely dangerous. That should be stopped. That should be stopped. Believe me, like, I think the result of all the craziness that's happening right now, and sadly, I think it's just going to get worse and worse. But I think at this point, it's like when the U.S. had the World Cup in 1994. Now, stay with me. This is a good analogy. The U.S. had the World Cup in 1994. I was working at a youth hostel then. And I remember everybody in the world coming to see it because they loved soccer. And Americans were like, soccer? Why is everybody into soccer? Right now, everybody is starting to see what has been going on here for years. They're seeing it just now. This is like the World Cup in 94. It's 20 years before America is actually deep into it. Or like, we're just learning now. We're just seeing how the sausage is getting made. So at this point, Americans got to make a choice. Like, are we going to work towards solving this problem, or are we going to just sweep it back under the rug? It can't. But here's the thing. It can't be swept under the rug anymore. Because it's rotten sausage. It's terrible sausage. It's not good for you. It's not that good sausage that you get at the local farm here in North Carolina.
So what kind of response do you get when you take your slideshow around? I mean, who shows up, first of all? I've always wondered about those kind of let's have a community conversation. Seems like the only people who show up are the people who are already converted. But who shows up and what kind of conversations do you have?
It's pretty amazing. It isn't that. I think a lot of different people show up and they're curious as to how I approach this stuff. And I use humor to get at some of the issues. But, you know, my main goal is to say, like, it's time to have the awkward conversation. We are so used to pharmaceutical companies telling us you never have to feel bad ever again. You never have to feel awkward or anything. We have to have the awkward conversation. So this show is having that awkward conversation. And I get everyone from people who are just totally on board to people who are just thanking me for coming out and sort of bringing this and talking about this in the way I do. I've been confronted by a kid who is a son of a police officer, and he said to me, you know, more cops are shot every year than people like on the job. And I said, you can't say that now. This is not Fox News. We're live and we all have cell phones. So we can all, I said, look up the facts, like look up statistics. And if you can come up with the statistics, I'll invite you up here and you can share with everybody that. I've had people tell heart-wrenching stories of...
By the way, he did not come back.
No. Quietly slipped out and never showed up again.
It's just not true. Yeah.
But a lot of people write to me after saying, hey, like, I'm one of those guys who always said all lives matter. And the way you explain Black Lives Matter, like, really sort of made me see what, you know, what you mean by that. And you know, just really sort of, I've posted stuff on my website, just people who saying, I saw your slideshow and it really just made me think about things in a different way. And that's all I'm not going to solve anything, but I'm hopefully we're just moving forward the conversation.
You're thinking of moving on to other platforms as well. You'd like to get animated series?
I don't know if it's going to be animated or live action, but it's funny. Like the minute I decided to move from Los Angeles, everything started to happen. I got an agent at CAA. I get this big article on me in the local paper, and I had to pretend I was still going to live there. But then I got, after I moved to North Carolina, I got optioned by Sony to develop something for television. And so I've been sort of flying back and you know, meeting with potential writers and showrunners and stuff like that. So,
well, I wonder if this is any indication of the kind of sketch comedy that you want to do. You did this parody of sort of an antique auction, right?
Yes, Antiques Roadshow.
Antiques Roadshow.
If you ever watch Antiques Roadshow, I'm going to ruin it for you right now. You never see any black people on there because black people couldn't own anything. They got the stuff taken from them. That's like if you want to know what white privilege is, you'll never see a black person on Antiques Roadshow say, oh, my great uncle got this jade piece while he was in China. Because that stuff, if you had it, it got taken away from you some way, somehow. Any successful thing, a highway was built between it, or it was, you know, a huge riot and everything gets burned down and all that stuff. So if you want to see what white privilege is, watch Antiques Roadshow. Anyway, I did a parody of it, and it's about a woman who... you just have to watch it.
Well, I think we've got the punchline here, and I think this will work. Watch.
We found this in a shed in my grandmother's backyard after she passed. It was handed down from generation to generation, but we didn't know much about it, so we thought we'd bring it in.
All right. Let's take a look, shall we? Beatrice, do you have any idea what you have here?
No.
What you have here is an authentic antebellum plantation slave circa 1832 to 1840.
Really?
Look, there's a brand here. Property of Jedediah Ezekiel Smith.
No kidding.
Yes, well, there are no auctions nowadays for something like this, although you may try certain parts of Mississippi. However, if you were to auction him off today, he would easily fetch... $2, maybe $3 million. Easily.
Oh, should have dusted him off more often, right?
And we are looking at an live African American man whose hands are bound in chains.
That's the great thing about living in L.A. is you have access to all these great actors. Like, they all... were shocked that I gave them money for spending that day. Like, they were all ready to do it for free. And, like, it's amazing the resources there, how neat you could just...
I just want you to know that we took a chance with our white liberal audience because we're going to get angry emails about, are you kidding? You put an enslaved man on the radio and you've made fun of enslavery?
Yeah.
But you're going to do that, right? I mean, that's the edge. That's where you want to be with this kind of
stuff. That's where I want to be, because that's where I've been for a very long time. And I'll just tell you this. Like, my influences are Mad Magazine, Warner Brothers cartoons, Parliament Funkadelic albums, Doonesbury, just a lot of that type of stuff, you know, sort of cutting edge stuff. Spike Lee is a huge one. And
Jules Pfeiffer, too.
Yeah, Jules Pfeiffer, yeah. Norman Lear, All in the Family, those type of things. You know, I'm showing my age. But it's those type of things that sort of knock you out or get, you know, grab your attention. And but I hope to use humor to kind of get there. So,
well, have fun in San Diego. We'll have you back. Always good to talk with you, Keith.
Always a pleasure. I'm waiting for my show on WUNC, by the way.
Well, that'd be a great talk show, wouldn't it?
Yes,
it would.
A
little podcast, maybe, you and selected members of the community.
We'll see.
Talk about that. That's a good one. Keith Knight, creator of the Kay Chronicles, several collections of comics, and self-described gentleman cartoonist. Going to be the featured artist at Comic-Con in San Diego later this week. You can find out more about his work, take a look at some of the funnies at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Will Michaels, and Charlie Sheldon Ormond. Robin Copley is our technical director. Brent Wolf is WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.